Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, Screencraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out Screencraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Hey Script Apart listeners, welcome to our very final episode for 2023. I don't know about you guys, but I have no idea where this year has gone. Luckily, we're closing out with a bang today. Yes, my name's Al Horner. This is a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. And on today's show, the tremendously talented writer behind films like Little Miss Sunshine, Hunger Games: Catching Fire, and Star Wars: The Force Awakens is here, dropping by to break down his screenplay for a Pixar sequel that truly went to infinity and beyond. You guessed it, the great Michael Arndt is my guest this week, unraveling his script for 2010's fantastic Toy Story 3. Directed by past Script Apart guest Lee Unkrich, Toy Story 3 could have simply repeated the formula that made the franchise's previous installments an international phenomenon. 1995's original Toy Story changed the face of animation. Toy Story 2, 4 years later, cemented Woody, Buzz, and their found family of fellow playthings as among the most beloved characters in modern storytelling. A third Toy Story movie could have just served up more of the same. Instead, Michael and the famous Pixar Brain Trust opted for a tale that leapt forward in time, with the toy's owner, Andy, now all grown up and about to head to college. This milestone heaps existential questions on Woody and Co. Questions like, if a toy is retired to an attic, never to be played with again, what reason do they now have to exist? And what does it mean to be outgrown by people you love who seemingly no longer love you in return? If that sounds heavy for what is ostensibly a kid's tale, well, wait till I remind you that Toy Story 3 was a movie set mostly in a brutal toy internment camp that ends with our heroes about to be incinerated. That boldness is why many regard the film as being peak Pixar. And let's be real, can you blame those people? Toy Story 3, after all, was released at the end of a remarkable run of hits for the animation studio that included Ratatouille in 2007, Wall-E in 2008, and of course Up in 2009. Emboldened by the smash hit success of those movies, Toy Story 3 was a movie that found Michael and co. taking plenty of risks. Michael was picked to work on this project, presumably via email rather than a giant mechanical claw like the ones in Pizza Planet, because few storytellers do grounded emotion and dysfunctional families like he does. At the onset of his career, across 3 days in May 2000, he famously wrote a screenplay about a family on a road trip that became a monster hit. Little Miss Sunshine earned the Virginia-born screenwriter a Best Original Screenplay Oscar following the film's release in 2006, catapulting him onto the radar of Pixar who are beginning to cook up a new adventure for Rex, Ham, and the gang. In the conversation you're about to hear, Michael discusses coming aboard the movie and feeling the weight of pressure on his shoulders. We talk about the many early iterations of the movie, including an abandoned version from before Disney bought Pixar, in which our heroes travel to Taiwan after Buzz is shipped there following a global Buzz Lightyear product recall. You'll hear about the film's original ending, which saw the toys return to Al's Toy Barn from Toy Story 2. We get into the machinations of Lotso hugging Bear, how the story is deep down about parenthood, and of course, that traumatizing moment our heroes hold hands, staring down a violent death in the film's closing moments, a scene that I was not emotionally prepared for when I watched it for the first time. We recorded this interview a few weeks ago, but have been saving it to put in your feeds at Christmas because I thought it would be a wonderful episode to close the year out with. I don't know about anyone else, but I always tend to rewatch the Toy Story films at Christmas. No idea why, they're not festive in the slightest. If you enjoy this conversation, I should point out that you really ought to check out Michael's fantastic YouTube channel, which includes a great 82-minute film about writing Toy Story 3. I'll pop a link in the episode notes. Be sure to check it out because it comes up a lot in our conversation. Huge thanks to Michael, and thanks to you guys for listening to Script Apart in 2023. It's been such a fun year for the show. Special thanks are reserved, of course, for our Patreon community, without whom we could not keep making episodes. Script Apart is a completely independent operation made by two friends in our spare time, me and my producer Cam. The support of our Patreon subscribers is what allows us to keep the new episodes coming. So as the three-eyed aliens might say from the Toy Story franchise, we are eternally grateful. If you'd like to get involved, receiving ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and the chance to ask your questions to upcoming guests, head to patreon.com/scriptapart. We really do appreciate the support. Okay, this is a long episode, so I should probably cut to the chase and hand over to our fantastic guest. This is the wonderful Michael Arndt discussing the first draft secrets of Toy Story 3. Happy holidays, everyone. Have a safe and restful festive break. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Domecq. Michael, so great to have you with us. How's it going today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure's all mine, really, considering how many times I've watched and rewatched some of your films over the years, Toy Story 3 very much included. I love this film, Michael. I do understand, though, as a result of your 82-minute film on YouTube, that this was a very arduous project to get right, to get over the finishing line, which makes me wonder what your relationship is like with the film today. Like, does it give you slight PTSD thinking back on the creation of this movie 13 years on?
It totally gives me PTSD to think about it because I was under a ton of pressure, you know, and but it's also because the answer is both. Like, I'm also very, very proud of it because it was a real struggle and there was no luck involved. Like, it was a lot of sweat equity and hard work that went into making the whole thing work. And it was 3 years of my life. You know, it was 2006 to 2009. So, and I do feel like the script, I mean, the final movie ended up being very successful in what it set out to do, in what it set out to be, you know, and that's sort of the most that you can ask for. So yeah, it was very nerve-wracking the whole time working on it. Like, there was never a moment where I was relaxed at all or felt very confident, but the ideas sort of came when they needed to come, and, you know, it all ended up coming together in a way that I feel very lucky about. Like, you know, you can't force ideas to come. And it felt like all the ideas that we needed sort of came in the right time. So I just feel both like humble and grateful and just also, you know, proud that it worked out as well as it did.
Yeah. You mentioned it was a 3 year period there. Like in your film, you've described it as 3 years that were just a complete nightmare of anxiety and confusion, stumbling around in the dark in complete creative agony. It sounds like that wasn't really an exaggeration. You know, did that anxiety manifest in sleepless nights or something worse? What did that confusion and that strife look like for you, Michael?
It was just mostly, you know, when you need an idea and you don't have an idea, right? It's like an itch that you can't scratch, right? It's this thing that, or it's like having a toothache. Like, it's hard to think about anything else because you're just, you know, you're trying to find an idea and you don't have one, you know, and you just, and when you don't have an idea, you think you'll never get another one again. You think that you run out, you know, the well is empty and you've run out, you know, for all time. And let me just also add, like, for proper context, the amount of pressure that I was under, which was five out of the last six Pixar films had been nominated for Best Original Screenplay, starting with Finding Nemo. And then I remember when I signed up to do Toy Story 3, I went back and I looked at like the Rotten Tomatoes score for Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2, and they were both at 100%. So if I fell short of like 100% in Rotten Tomatoes, I was going to be a disappointment. If I didn't get nominated for Best Screenplay, I was going to be a disappointment. And then Up, which came out the year before us, got nominated for Best Picture, which had almost never happened with an animated film. Only Beauty and the Beast had been nominated for Best Picture before. So again, like, if we didn't get nominated for Best Picture, that was also going to be seen as sort of falling short of what had previously been established. So, and then I was coming off Little Miss Sunshine, and Little Miss Sunshine, you know, to pat myself on the back, they had given me an Oscar for that. So I was following Little Miss Sunshine and trying to step into the big, very big shoes of Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2. So there was a sense that, like, I, you know, you kind of had to hit it out of the park. Like, it had to be great. And I remember actually when I first got hired, one of the executives at Pixar came up to me and shook my hand and sort of congratulated me. And he goes, "It's going to be great. It's going to be great. We're really looking forward to it. It's going to be great, but don't screw it up. But you're going to be great. You're going to be great. We know it's going to be great, but don't screw it up."
Did the fact that you'd written Little Miss Sunshine in just 3 days make it all the more agonizing, the amount of time and strain that Toy Story 3 took to get right? Like, I can imagine it being all the more shocking to you how many iterations of the film that you had to write to get it where it needed to be after Little Miss Sunshine just tumbled out of you from the sounds of things.
It was just a huge difference because when I wrote Little Miss Sunshine, I was very much like the prickly loner writer. Like, I was just like, everybody shut up and leave me alone and I'm going to go off by myself and write a screenplay. And so I did. And when I got to Pixar, I mean, my joke was that, like, writing a screenplay by yourself is like you're trying to paddle a raft across the Atlantic. And then when I got hired by Pixar, it was like a giant ocean liner pulled up next to me. And they're like, "Oh, you're trying to cross the Atlantic. We're crossing the Atlantic, but we have a shuffleboard and we have, you know, a buffet and we have everything." So it really, going to Pixar really changed my perspective on writing because, you know, everybody there is all helping each other. It's a real creative community. There's a real collaborative spirit there, and everybody's trying to do the same thing. Everyone's trying to tell great stories, and telling great stories involves sort of the same set of problems. How do you introduce your character? How to get your audience engaged? So it was very eye-opening, and it ended up being sort of a great follow-up experience to Little Miss Sunshine that I didn't have to go back and sit by myself in a room and write a screenplay again, that I could be in this big, very well-supported creative community and have all these collaborators helping me out.
I suppose another big kind of difference between the projects with regards to Little Miss Sunshine and Toy Story 3 is Little Miss Sunshine, you were inventing characters, and here with Toy Story 3, you were inheriting these characters that meant so much to people and perhaps even meant a lot to yourself. Can you talk to me about that pressure on top of, like, you know, the demands on you to deliver something critically acclaimed? There's also an emotional connection that people have to these characters that you had to satisfy.
Yeah, no, I mean, first of all, it's a huge luxury to come on and have the characters already be existing, because half of your job as a writer is trying to figure out who your characters are. And if that's already been defined, then that's a huge, you're halfway to the goal line at that point. So that was a real luxury. But on the other hand, it was a bit of a curse, because I remember I had written the first draft and we went into a story meeting, and in the story meeting, Andrew Stanton literally said, he goes, "This doesn't sound like Woody. It sounds like someone who's imitating what he thinks Woody should sound like." And I was like, I'm standing right here, Andrew. I'm sitting right here. I'm the guy that you're referring to." So there was a pressure to, you know, you wanted to get it right. You wanted you wanted to be faithful to those voices and the characters as people knew and loved them.
So how did you go about that? How did you get into the voice of these characters? Because, yeah, that can't have been easy.
I should say that, I mean, before I say anything else, I have to say that they were very generous in giving me the screenwriting credit for Toy Story 3. But the truth is, and I say it in the video, that there was a whole team of people, right? It was not just Leon Christensen, the director, Jason Kat's the head of story. Andrew Stan Lee Unkrich and Andrew and John Lasseter, who all got story credit. But it was about, you know, 10 other guys, all the story artists who were there helping out. So if I ever strayed a little bit, there were always these big guardrails for me to sort of usher me back into or just check me and go, this doesn't sound like Ham. This doesn't sound like Potato Head. This doesn't sound like Rex. So it didn't all fall up to me. And I should say, every time I say, you know, we came up with this idea, it very much was a group writing process up there. It very much was everybody like this massive organic story brain coming together to produce this thing. So in a way, like, I feel a little guilty even being up here talking about the screenplay as the writer, because it was really this group effort.
Let me just zero in a little bit further on your relationship with this franchise before we get into Toy Story 3 itself. Can you remember your first time watching Toy Story, and whether you can't, you're shaking your head.
I totally can. Yeah, no, I was shaking my head because I was remembering that seeing it for the first time and like being so impressed, just so impressed by like what a great, funny, entertaining story it was, especially the first Toy Story movie, that action scene at the end where they're all trying to get on the moving van sort of at the last minute. And I remember walking out of the theater. I saw it with my cousin, who was like 6 years old at the time. And I was just sort of blown away. I was like, wow, that was a great movie. And it just set the bar very high. I mean, in terms of storytelling, it's just brilliant storytelling. You know, and so I remember walking out and going, these guys really know what they're doing. And it's funny, I remember when Incredibles came out, Incredibles, you know, which was 2005, I think, came out. So it was right before I got hired at Pixar. But Incredibles was a film that I saw in the theater. And then I went back the next week and just saw it again in the theater again, because I was so impressed with it. So you can imagine my surprise when my agent called me up and said, hey, Pixar is interested in working with you, because they seem to be doing just fine without me. And I was so I'm very flattered even to get the call, and then just very, very excited, you know, to go up there and interview for the job.
Yeah. And did you have a take after that first experience with Toy Story about what it was that connected with you so profoundly? Because, you know, both Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2, they're both immaculately told stories. They have spectacle to them. They're kind of breaking new ground in terms of visuals. But I'm curious as to like the emotional reasons, in your opinion, as to why the films have sparked such a connection with people, why people care about Woody and Buzz so greatly.
Speaking personally for myself, I just feel like there's a sense of exuberance in those films. There's a sense of play, a little bit of mischief, a sense of fun, a sense of visual dynamism. Like, I feel like they're not like that. All those tracking shots and the whip pans and stuff like that. There's just a sense. There's a love of filmmaking. I'll put it that way. There's just a love. You see it in the films themselves, a love of filmmaking. And that's always what made me just sort of an admirer of those films. They're incredibly crafted. I mean, again, half the reason I went back to watch the Incredibles was just the production design and the music, you know, and the character design. Like, it's all so great. And then just the characters were so great. I remember seeing the film for the first time, and the moment in which Buzz realizes that he actually is a toy, you know, and he's watching that TV commercial, is just that's a great moment. Like, that's a great screenwriting moment of a character having to face the truth about himself. So part of it was just like, these guys, you know, we all go to see so many movies that don't quite work, right? That are a little bit disappointing, that don't quite come together. And when you go and you see these films where everything works and everything fits together and everything is just clicking along and firing all cylinders, for me, it was just this sort of like abiding sense of a love of cinema that I admired so much, and that I didn't want to let down, that I didn't want to screw up, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, one of the kind of most magical things about Pixar, and one of the most kind of extraordinary things about what they pull off time and time again, is the degree to which like their premises can be so outlandish. Like, you're watching toys, you're watching superheroes, you're watching bugs, you know, no matter how kind of far from us as humans in the audience these kind of protagonists stray, there's something always so primal that the movie kind of taps into, and Toy Story, and especially Toy Story 3, are such great examples of that. Is there anything you can speak to in that regard as to, the sort of philosophy there that kind of always grounds these films in something so painfully relatable?
It's funny that people have asked me, like, what's the difference between writing for animation and writing for live action? And I was like, there's no difference. There's no difference at all. You're just, I mean, I guess you have a little bit more freedom that you can have almost anything happen in animation. But I was always treating these characters as though they were real people with real concerns. Like, you never want to condescend to your characters. You never want to make fun of them in any way. You want to treat them and their concerns as seriously as you can. And I remember also, I remember Lee Unkrich saying, like, we don't, one of the things we do at Pixar is we don't do funny voices. Like, we don't have our actors put on exaggerated voices, you know, for their animated characters. And, you know, Lee said when Tom Hanks is playing Woody, he's just using his Tom Hanks voice. Like, he's just talking in a very plain way. And, you know, that just goes to this sort of commitment to sort of an emotional realism, not going for cheap entertainment, right? Not going for any sort of like goofiness. Again, it just comes down to not condescending to your characters, you know, taking them seriously as people, even if they're just little plastic toys, taking them very seriously.
You mentioned there the distinction between animation and live action. Animation, you know, it isn't bound to the same challenges that filmmakers face in live action. Characters often have to grow older in franchises because the actors do. Toy Story 3 didn't have to lurch forward in time so boldly in ways that would force such confrontation with mortality and the idea of growing old and unwanted. This could have been just another timeless adventure in Andy's bedroom. But instead, you came on board and you were handed this spine of a story, this beginning, middle and end, in which kind of Andy had grown up and he's about to move to college. That's act one. The toys decide to donate themselves to a daycare center, only to discover it's a bit of a hellhole, act two. And then finally, Andy hands over these toys that he loved to someone new who can cherish them as their own, act three. Can you talk to me about your first reaction to that skeleton of the story? And yeah, what you recall in terms of your conversations with the Brain Trust about what guided them towards that premise? Because as I say, this was an animation. They didn't have to go there, but they chose to.
Yeah, no, I feel like the smartest decision in the writing process was the first decision, which was to have screen time, the time in the Toy Story universe, have elapsed in the same time period as real life. So if we last saw Andy when he was 8 years old, and 8 years have elapsed, and 10 years have elapsed in real life, then 10 years have elapsed in screen time, and we're going to meet him, and he's going to be 18 years old. Just think about like how easy it would have been to just keep Andy 8 years old forever and have the toys go out on one adventure after another, you know, and Andy always remains 8 years old. And I just feel like it was a real challenge, right? Because you're dealing with characters who are feeling dispossessed and feeling like they are sort of outmoded and not wanted anymore. But that is giving you a real powder keg of emotion when you start off the story. But then the great thing about aging the characters in real time is that it gives you an automatic ending. Like it forces a crisis in this whole universe, right? That Annie's grown up and he's leaving for college and something's going to happen. And I think the real genius, I remember, was having the toys, you introduce them at the beginning and they need a new home, but they don't see any way of getting it. And just in the course of going through the second act, Woody's going to end up stumbling into Bonnie's room, right? And that's going to be the answer that you're going to pay off sort of at the end of the third act. So I'll just say the very first decision was the smartest decision, having age in real time.
And when you're kind of having the discussions about, you know, a plot like that, a premise like that, how vulnerable are you guys all being in your own experiences and your own lives and the things that you're bringing to the table that might inform a story like this? Are you like, because as we'll get to in this conversation, this is an amazing allegory for parenthood. This film, were people there talking about like you know, their fears about their children growing up and abandoning them? Like, talk to me about the level of like therapy speak, I suppose, in the writers' commune.
Those Pixar writer rooms are so great because you're talking about story issues, right? You're talking about the film that you're working on, and a lot of times you branch out and you go, okay, well, how did other films do it? So then you talk about Star Wars, or you talk about Jaws, or you're talking about something else. But then a lot of times you just branch off into everyone's personal stories, and people go, you know, when my son left for college, I felt X, you know, or I remember John Lasseter saying, like, you know, when he watched the scene where Andy's mom walks into Andy's room at the end and it's all cleared out and there's nothing more, everything's been packed up. He was like, there's nothing you can say in that moment. Like I felt that before, you know? And I remember actually Andrew Stanton saying he had a great thing about Woody's relationship with Andy, he said that like at the end, when Woody places himself in the donation box, you know, at the bottom of the box, and Andy finds him, Andrew was like, it's like raising a kid in that you can lead your kid, you can up to the point of making the right decision, right? But you can't make that decision for your kid. Like, you got to let your kid make that decision, you know, and they could choose wrong. Like, they could go the right way or the wrong way, but you can't make decisions for your kid. You have to just lead them to the point where they would make the right decision. And that was just really interesting that he was bringing his own sort of philosophy of parenthood into the storytelling of that thing, so that at the end, Andy's going to pick up Woody, you know, and Bonnie's going to say, there's a snake in my boots, right? And he's going to have that moment of hesitation before he hands Woody over. So yeah, again, those Pixar story meetings are so great in that people, you know, you're talking about just the logic of the story and what's the logical thing to happen next. You're talking about, you know, analogies of other movies, but a lot of people, you know, bring their, you're telling personal stories and going, here's, you know, here's what happened to me, here's how I felt. And it really, you know, hopefully resonates in the final product.
Were there personal stories of your own that you remember bringing to the table?
Let me see. I'm not a parent yet, knock on wood. So I can't say that I bring anything specific to that. Jeez, let me think. Let me put it this way, because this is interesting, is that I do feel like stories tend to have an organic logic to them, an organic sort of narrative logic to them, and also an organic emotional logic to them. And so when I was hired to do Toy Story 3, and I hadn't worked on the first two Toy Story movies, it kind of wasn't about me, you know, it wasn't about my personal experience, right? I was totally coming in as an outsider, and being given these characters and given this story, it really was, you know, there could have been a temptation for me to sort of try to put in my own personal agenda into the movie. But in this case, it felt like the right thing to do was just to look at the characters, look at like what the story was demanding of them, and follow that logic to the most extreme, like to push it as far as it could go, so that the sadness was going to be as sad as it could be. The scariness was going to be as scary as it could be. The humor was going to be as humorous as it could be. But that I was sort of being given this great thing with these great characters, and just trying to make it work as best it could by following the inherent logic of the story, if that makes sense.
And in terms of what was already there, what perhaps was kind of to be inherited if needed, there was reportedly a Toy Story 3 script in existence before this one that, you know, existed from before Disney bought Pixar. And I think it was written by Jim Herzfeld, who wrote Meet the Parents.
Yep.
From what I'm aware, it had something to do with Buzz being shipped to Taiwan as part of like a product recall. Was that something you read or have read since, or did you avoid it purposely as to not absorb any of those ideas?
No, I was forbidden to read that. Like, it was like we were all strictly quarantined because, yeah, just for legal reasons. Like, you just, like, we were not allowed to. And I should have gone back and dug up that draft and read it and take a look at it. Because I'm sure, I mean, Jim is a great writer. Meet the Parents is a great, great movie. And I'm sure he came up with something very funny. And it must be very heartbreaking. You know, I mean, it's just one of these things that you're a victim of these giant corporate mergers, you know. But the Circle 7 script was something that we had always heard about, but that we were kind of very specifically told, like, do not go even take a look at it or anything like that, because it could, you know, get us into legal hot water. I'll just say when I first got to Pixar and they said, you know, we want you to keep, they were like, anything you write down, we want you to save it because we're going to archive it. We're going to put it in boxes. We're going to keep everything you write. And I was just like, oh my God, they think so highly of my writing that they want to keep every single thing that I write. And then they said, no, it's not that at all. It's just that we get sued on every film that we make. And so it's all for our legal protection. We have to say, like, every scrap of paper that you write down, you have to save, because they've gotten sued on every single project that they've made. Yeah.
So let's talk first draft. Like, for anyone who is yet to see your video about the writing of Toy Story 3, could you give a brief summary of how different that draft was? Because, you know, it seems from your film, like, a lot of the kind of parts of the finished film still exist in those early reels, but they just went through a lot of recalibrating to make sure the story was really firing in quite subtle ways.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just thinking about this last night in preparation for this interview, and it made me realize there were a ton of moments, like in that first early draft, which was based, again, I should say, on a 24-page or 25-page treatment that Andrew Stanton wrote up, there were a lot of things that changed completely between the first draft and the finished film. For example, like the trip to the dump was not in the first draft. In the third act, they never went to the dump at the end. So that was something that got added in later. There's just a ton of things, and we can talk about this. I'm happy to just start on page one and go like how everything was different. But again, it's amazing to me some of the jokes that were in Andrew's first treatment, even the Lincoln Logs joke, for example, which was not mine, it was Andrew's, but that made it into the final thing. So there were some jokes, some ideas that made it, you know, a little early in Bonnie that was, you know, rock solid all the way through. And it's a funny part of the writing process. Sometimes you stumble across these diamonds early on and they just stay fixed like in the script forever. And then a lot of stuff, you're either throwing stuff out and inventing completely new stuff, or you're taking what's already there and just trying to tweak it and optimize it.
Well, if you want to go page one, we can start with a discussion about like that big, exciting opening scene that we have in the finished film that kind of, for the first time in this franchise, delves inside Andy's imagination. And I love that opening and all its callbacks to kind of past Toy Story movies and catchphrases. But I think more than anything, I love how it underlines the kind of imagination and sense of play that toys unlock in kids. And I guess the love that kids can forge with their toys as a result. We need to be reminded of that as an audience, I suppose, before we see that love seemingly broken. Can you talk to me about, this opening scene and the degree to which it was always in the script?
Yeah, it's so funny that you bring this up, because first of all, I remember everybody was very excited by the idea that we're going to go inside what play looks like from the toys' point of view. For the first time, we're going to really see what play looks like. But the funny thing is, and I don't know if people know this or not, that big sort of train heist opening that starts the movie now was not part of the original thing. The very first thing was a sort of high noon showdown, Western showdown between Buzz and Woody. And they were meeting on a street, you know, in the Old West, and they were facing off against each other. And it was this awkward thing. It was not action packed. They were just sitting there going, this town's too small for both of us, Sheriff. Yep. Uh-huh. And it didn't evolve. Like there was no story really being told. So it ended up being very boring. And we ended up just sort of throwing it out and coming up with this bigger, sort of more fun, you know, space aliens and crazy things happening, you know, the barrel of monkeys thing happening. But the very first thing that we tried, and I wrote, I don't know, 10 different versions of this thing, and I think we started boarding it, was it started out as a showdown, like a high noon showdown in a Western town, and then it just ended up being too boring, and we just threw it out. And then I think it was interesting for you to say that the whole thing about establishing the relationship between Andy and the toys in terms of playtime, because in the very first draft, and I was just remembering this last night, you know, the premise had been 10 years have elapsed, Andy's grown up. So Andy's grown up, he's 18 years old now. But then they also wanted to start off with this big playtime thing, this big playtime moment. And the question is, how are you going to connect those two things together? And especially, you know, the premise had also been, if Andy's grown up, he's 18 years old, he hasn't played with the toys in years and years and years. So then the question is like, well, why are we getting this big opening? Why are we getting this big playtime opening? Like if they haven't been played with for years and years and years. So the rationale that I got was, you know, in the treatment was, well, they're rehearsing to be played with just in case Andy picks them up and starts playing with them again. They want to be ready to play, which was sort of okay, but it's not a great idea, right? You go, well, if they can just play on their own and have these fun adventures on their own, then why are they yearning to be played with by Andy? The other thing was that you're not establishing the emotional stakes of the story by seeing the love of that Andy has as a young child for his toys. So this ended up being like one of the late additions to the script. And we ended up making this argument that we needed to begin in a golden age. Like, and the sequence itself was called Golden Age, you know, that we needed to meet Andy when he was 8 years old and show him playing with the toys and show how great it was, how much fun it was, how much Andy loved his toys, how much the toys loved Andy. So we were going to start with this big action set piece, right? And then what we ended up coming up with was, you're going to be in the Old West with this action set piece. And then right at the climax, you're going to snap out of it, right? And you're going to come into Andy's room and Andy's going to be 8 years old, and you're going to see, oh, this is 8 year old Andy playing with his toys. This is how much fun it is. This is the golden age. This is the high point between a child and his toys with all this imaginative play. And then the problem that you have is, how do you connect 8 year old Andy to 18 year old Andy? So I'll pat myself on the back a little bit. I came up with the device of the camcorder. So you're going to come out of the Old West into Andy's bedroom. And then 20 seconds later, you're going to jump into the point of view of Andy's mom coming with a camcorder. The camcorder is going to allow you to hopscotch now through time and space and see a birthday party, seeing getting measured against the door. But what you're doing in that opening sequence, the golden age, is just solidifying, underlying how much these toys love Andy, how much Andy loves the toys, so that you have, so that when you get into the actual, you know, movie, in the present, and Annie comes in and opens up the toys, and you see that he's 18 years old, you want to feel a little bit of a gut punch, right? That, oh my God, the kid's grown up, the kid's going away to college. But that wasn't in there. That whole golden age sequence wasn't in the original script. And so, again, it's one of those things, this is what writing is, right? It's figuring out what you need and what's going to serve the story. It's funny now, but that was one of the last things that got added to the movie. And I remember them saying, well, if we have this whole new sequence, golden age, it's going to add to the budget. And I was like, trust me, it's going to pay off, because all the emotion that you're getting at the end of the movie, right, which is saying goodbye to this child you love so much, has to be set up in those first 5 minutes of seeing how great the relationship is with Andy and his toys when he's 8 years old.
Well, it's so effective at establishing the kind of philosophical stakes of the story. That question, what is a child's love for a toy? Is it real? That's going to run through the entire film and become like the central question, I suppose.
Exactly. And if you didn't see that initial love, like if you didn't see it, then Woody, who goes through the whole movie insisting Andy still cares about us. Guys, you got to believe me, Andy still cares about us. If you hadn't seen that initial, those first 10 minutes, then Woody would just seem delusional, right? You would just go, what are you talking about? He's 18 years old. He's going to college. He's not going to, he just doesn't care about us anymore. So you really, really needed it. But it's funny. I mean, again, I remember Andrew Stanton saying, like, the ending at Pixar, like, the last thing we end up doing is fixing the first act. Because once you finally figure out what your ending is going to be, then you have to go back and adjust your first act to make it really work. But it's interesting that I think a great first act is really, really hard to do. And it was this case, in this case with Toy Story also, like the golden age sequence was the last sequence that got added to the whole script.
The scene that follows, as we kind of fast forward 10 years to find our beloved characters, in the midst of this operation to get Andy to retrieve them from the toy chest that they've been sat dormant in, that's an existential nightmare right there. It kind of implies something very dark. I'm reminded of that Bo Burnham lyric about the frightening state of sleep paralysis. Can you talk to me about getting this kind of tonally right? Because as a concept, it's right there on the brink of an extreme darkness if you think about it too much.
The metaphor that we always used was, because they talk about their little meetings that they have as staff meetings. Like, I remember Lee Unkrich saying, this is a workplace. These guys consider themselves professionals, right? And Woody will go, staff meeting, guys, we're having a staff meeting. And so I very deliberately chose, you know, this opening scene where it has to be a threshold moment, right? It has to be a thing where you go, this is our, you don't even know it at the time, but this is our last chance, right? So that when they try to induce Andy to come in and pick them up and play with them, and he doesn't, in the wake of that, he leaves, and Woody's going to say, guys, everybody get together, we need a staff meeting. And he goes, you know, I'm calling it, guys. We're closing up shop. You know, that was our last shop, right? And the metaphor that I used was, you know, closing up shop is like, you know, it's a factory that's closing down. It's just like we've all been in this workplace for 20 years. We've all been making joy and happiness, you know, together. But now, like, our run is over. We're closing up shop. We're going into attic mode. We all knew this day was coming, you know. So in all the story meetings, we talked about it, you know, very much in the vocabulary of professional retirement, that you had done a job. You did the best job you could, but now it's over and you're closing up shop and you're going into attic mode and you're going to, you know, retire to the attic.
It seems like there was a bit of a recalibration of the tone of this first act, Michael. Like in your YouTube film, there's kind of glimpses at early footage and early dialogue that, it kind of veers a bit more towards nihilism. Like Mr. Potato Head is saying some quite dark things at times. Can you talk to me about those calibrations and, in particular, how you calibrated the characters' expectations for what's going to happen in Act One? Because From the sounds of things, that was a massive obstacle for you guys. Like, everything else hinges upon us as an audience understanding those expectations.
Yeah, this was, it's amazing, but this was the hardest thing to figure out in the whole movie, was just what do the characters think their future is going to be? Like, what are their expectations? Like, if Andy's grown up and he's going off to college, like, what are they expecting? And I mean, I talk about this a little bit in my video, but the main thing was you're opening and you're setting your character, whatever your character expectations are, is going to get disrupted in the inciting incident of the story, right? So you got to be very clear and careful about establishing your character's expectations so that when your inciting incident comes along and disrupts them, your audience is going to feel it and it's really going to resonate. And so early on, I mean, this is just a good example of how things change in the story. The expectations were, I'll just say, like, the very first draft of the movie, they were all kind of hoping to go to college with Andy. They were all kind of hoping that Andy was going to take them all to college with them. And the rationale for that was, the inciting incident was Andy was going to come in and his mom was going to say, well, you're packing up for college. Are you going to take your toys with you? And he's going to say, no, I'm not taking them with me. Maybe Woody. And then she's going to say, well, do you want to give your toys away or donate the toys? And he's going to say, mom, no one's going to want those old toys. They're junk, right? For a long time, that was the inciting incident of the story, right? Was just like their expectations for the future, which was their hopes of going to college are going to get dashed, right? And then you're going to add an insult to injury moment in which Andy's going to call the toys junk. And that in and of itself was going to be the inciting incident of the story. And that in and of itself was going to prompt Buzz to go, well, screw this. Andy doesn't want us anymore. He's called us junk. I'm going to go hop in the donation box that we've previously established, and I'm going to donate myself to Sunnyside. And we had, so that was the first draft of it. And for a long time, man, I just did so many drafts of that version of the story trying to get it to work. And it just didn't work over and over again. And obviously one of the reasons it doesn't work is A, it just makes, like, the toys have these unrealistic set of expectations, right? Like, they just seem kind of, if they think they're going to college with Andy, if they think they're going to stay with Andy forever, they're kind of deluded, right? Toys, like, kids don't keep their toys forever. So if the toys are hoping to go to college with Andy, you're not really sympathetic to them because it's just a sort of a delusional hope. And then they also seem thin-skinned, right? If Andy just says no one's going to want those old toys, they're junk, then they're going to go, even if they've been with him for, I don't know, his whole life, they're going to go, well, that's it, screw you. It's going to make them seem peevish and thin-skinned. So the whole goddamn inciting incident story just didn't work for the longest effing time. Like, it was torture. I was just like, oh my God, like, this thing isn't working. And people are going, yeah, it just feels weak. It's not properly motivating them. We're like, I'm not rooting for them to go to daycare. And again, we went in circles, like, on this for, it just felt like months and months and months. And I tell this story in the video, that finally I was, you know, we were in a story meeting and Andrew Stanton said, just keep going. You guys are going to find it. And I was like, no, forget it. Forget everything we've done. Forget it. What if the toys are in a box or in a trash bag and they're on the curb and a trash truck is coming for them? And Andrew was like, bingo, that's it. Like, if you can find a way to get to that moment in the story, then I'm on board with anything the toys do after that. So, and this was a huge moment. And this is something I'm proud of. Like, I'll pat myself on the back for it, is because you're creating this big action sequence where the toys mistakenly get placed in a trash bag and then mistakenly put out on the curb and they barely escape the trash truck. So you're establishing for the third act the threat of the trash truck. It just gives you the proper motivation, you know, that the toys are going to go, oh my God, Andy put us in a trash bag. Like, you know, obviously he doesn't care about us anymore. And then the donation box just seems like this logical a solution to their problem. And it also does a good job of splitting the story between Andy on the one hand and the toys on the other hand, because Woody's able to see what really happened, see the truth about what happened. So, but again, like, you know, in the first draft, it was the expectations were, we're all hoping that Andy's going to take us to college. And then the inciting incident was, I'm not taking them to college and no one's going to want those old toys. They're all junk. And it was just it just took forever to solve that problem.
It's amazing hearing you talk about the recurring imagery of trash not being originally in the film, because it's a movie about characters fearing they are disposable. They are fearing being junk and being thrown out. It's so perfect.
Well, and I'll give you another example. And this is such a great example of how Pixar works as sort of the storytelling community, collaborative community, because I had also wanted, like, in those early scenes, you want to establish the threat that they could be thrown away. Like, that, those are the storm clouds on the horizon. Like, there's a danger out there that they could be thrown away. And I wrote, 10 different versions of the scene in which Andy's mom says to Andy, well, you better be careful. Like, if you don't pack up everything, or you don't, if you're not careful, the toys are going to get thrown away. Like, and it was always this conversation between Andy and his mom, and it never worked because it always felt like just naked on those exposition. And I tried to, you know, you try as a writer, you're sitting there trying to be subtle about it and subtle about it. And you're alluding to it, but you want to be clear that it's this threat. And it just wasn't working. And what happened was, like, one day I'm at Pixar and there's a fire alarm goes off, and it was a fire drill. And everybody floods out of the building and goes and stands in on the lawn in front of the building. And I just end up standing next to Andrew Stanton. And he goes, hey, how's it going on Toy Story 3? And I was like, I got this problem that trying to establish that the toys are afraid of being thrown away. But I don't know how to introduce that problem. Every time I have the Andy and his mom talk about it, it just feels clunky. And Andrew just thought, like, in 1 second, he goes, oh, don't give that idea to the human characters. Give it to a toy character. You should have a toy who's a Cassandra who goes, you know, when the trash bags, I mean, this was the final dialogue in the movie. When the trash bags come out, we army guys are the first to go. Right. So, and it was so smart to go, obviously, the bringer of that news, the bringer of that possibility should not be human. It should be another toy. Right. So we had to introduce the threat that they're going to be thrown away, but through the voice of the army guys. And then it's just funny. It's the army guys because they're so, I mean, I used to have those little army guys when I was a kid. And they're really like the low man on the totem pole in terms of toys because they have no personality whatsoever. They're all just generic green guys. So I always thought it was funny to have. And then the other thing that was interesting was, you know, their vocabulary, Sarge's vocabulary, is this army vocabulary. We've served our tour of duty. Like, we've done everything we can. We're moving on. Like, we're going on to a new mission or something like that. But yeah, it's funny that you bring up that question, because again, it was just one of those small things that as a writer, you can sit and get stuck in a little circular thinking and not be able to see your way out of it. And just having another person come in from the outside and go, oh, do it this way, and you solve the problem in 2 seconds.
The army guys are interesting. They're not the only characters who are part of this kind of Toy Story family that you immediately take out of the picture. There's a line in this scene about losing Bo Peep, and it's tinged with such heartbreak. And it reminded me, when I was kind of doing my research, of something else he once described about doing a first draft of The Force Awakens, having Luke Skywalker as a much bigger presence in that, and then realizing that, you know, this doesn't work with him in. He's not serving the story and he's upstaging everyone else. The audience can't forge a connection to the new heroes of that film because Luke's there and they just want to know what Luke's up to. It seems like you have a ruthlessness when it comes to seeing which characters kind of aren't working for the film and taking them out because that's just what serves the story best. I'm sure Bo Peep, there was a different rationale to taking that character out. Can you talk me through the story there?
Yeah, I mean, there was always this question, like, who's going to be part of this core group that's going to go on this adventure? And of course, Bo Peep, you know, had been there in the first two films. But then I remember Lee Unkrich saying, you know, the climax of the movie, right, is Andy, like, talking to Bonnie, handing over all his toys to her. And especially he has to personalize it. So, you know, the potato heads are madly in love with each other. You got to keep them together, right? Buzz Lightyear, the coolest toy ever made. And Lee Unkrich said, I can't imagine Andy saying, and this is Bo Peep, she's my sister's lamp. You know, like, there's just no rationale for Andy handing, you know, Bo Peep over to Bonnie. And because of that, because, I mean, I guess there could have been a way that she could have gone on the adventure and then found a new home somewhere or gotten lost or something like that. But because there was no end point for her in the story, it just makes sense to cut her out. And then we just ended up with sort of a sort of, you know, it's better not to explain too much, you know, just go, you know, like, you know, Wheezy and Bo Peep, like, you just, like, you know, these are comrades that have, you know, are not around anymore, but you don't have to over explain sort of what actually happened to them.
I should also probably ask about the idea of this gang of characters as kind of a family, because, well, it's interesting. You have a lot of characters here who individually
are quite dysfunctional. You've got Rex, who's a bundle of anxiety. You've got Mr. Potato Head, who is very grumpy. Together, though, all these dysfunctional characters, they kind of form a functioning family unit. There's something about when they all get together, their personalities kind of even each other out and they're able to accomplish things. That was also kind of the case in Little Miss Sunshine, which makes me wonder, Michael, what the experience of writing that film equipped you with in terms of like the screenwriting tools to take on a film like this, Toy Story 3.
Yeah, it made me not afraid of group ensemble storytelling. Like it made me not afraid to go like the ensemble itself is the hero, you know, and the ensemble itself is the thing that you're trying to hold together. The ensemble itself, the family itself, is the thing that you put at stake, you know, that could be broken up, you know, if Woody leaves and goes back to Andy and abandons everybody. So I think that. And then I was just very used to, you know, the thing with the Toy Story characters is they all serve a very specific function. So if you move them together as a group into any new situation, right, you can count on Rex being the voice of anxiety and stress. You can count on Potato Head to be the voice of pessimism, right? You can count on Woody to be the sort of thoughtful optimist, like, guys, we're going to fix this. And there's a way in which you get all the characters to sort of serve whatever story need at that moment, you know, to have them articulate something. I'll say something else, which is, and this is a little bit unexpected, but I remember, you know, Bullseye's along for the ride too. And Bullseye doesn't speak, like he's a nonverbal character, but I remember going like, we can use Bullseye as sort of the emotional thermometer of a scene, right? So that if it's a sad scene, you know, when Woody's left and you cut back to Sunnyside, we start with Bullseye, you know, and Bullseye's all sad and upset that Woody's left. And Jesse has to say, you know, he's going back to Andy's. He's going to be fine, you know, without us. So it's interesting, even a non-speaking character like Bullseye, you can use them to articulate whatever the governing principle of the governing emotion of the moment is. And I just think that, you know, I grew up in a big family, you know, so I grew up in a big family with a lot of voices and people sort of yelling at each other all the time. So I'm very comfortable with people talking over each other and insulting each other and just sort of that kind of fun dialogue, you know, and I feel like that's what we love in movies, is that sort of fun ping pong dialogue. So I'll just say that the way Little Miss Sunshine prepared me was just not being afraid to give each person their own little arc, you know, have Buzz be sort of tongue-tied around Jesse when the movie begins, and then the whole Spanish Buzz thing sort of allows him to relax a little bit so that at the end he can hold her hand and not be flustered at the end. So you just give each person their own little arc, and that's enough. Hopefully that's enough to be satisfying.
Yeah. And you mentioned Sunnyside there. That was one of the things that was handed to you that was already in place when you came aboard. Do you know what it is that the Brain Trust kind of wanted to explore through Sunnyside about the distinction between kind of being played with versus having like a child, having an owner?
Yeah, it's funny. We made this, we extended this analogy, like we talked forever about this because it's such a smart question. It's really brilliant, right? Which was, you know, the toys keep saying they want to get played with, right? But they want to be played with by Andy, this one special kid who plays with them and that they love, right? And the analogy that we made was sort of like when they go to Sunnyside, it's like they're going to have young kids forever. It's like that they're in this sort of bachelor's paradise where, or this dating world paradise where, like, when the kids grow up, a new set of kids come in. And so you're always getting played with, but you don't have a special one-to-one relationship commitment to this one special person that plays with you. And so we did have this, we talked, you know, endlessly about like the divorced dad, right? Who lands on his feet and is suddenly back in the dating world and can go out and date anyone he wants, you know, but is still a little bit heartbroken that his marriage didn't work out and he's still sort of secretly carrying a torch for his ex-wife. It's funny. We just talk endlessly about that stuff. And I think that everybody gets it. Like everybody gets that sort of like what we seek in life is that connection with another person, that sense of love. And if you're just, you know, getting played with by someone who's gonna graduate and leave the next year, you know, you're just not establishing those meaningful connections. And so it's fun, like while it's going on, but it doesn't feel very meaningful at the end. So yeah, it's funny. I mean, again, we had endless story. It's funny. Let me just say this, because this is really interesting. When you get lost in a story, sometimes, right, especially at Pixar, we would always go back to like, what would happen in real life? What is the real life analogy? Like, the way you anchor it, the way you come back to like, okay, what problem are we trying to solve here? Like, what is the way out of this problem that we can't figure a way out of, was to always try to find the human analogy and go, why explain it to me in human terms. You know, we did this on Toy Story 4, where we were talking about, when I briefly worked on that too, talking about how Woody had retired, like, and he's no longer, they're in Bonnie's room. Dolly is sort of the leader in Bonnie's room. And I always analogized him to like a guy who's a military guy, who's just sort of at the end of his career and he's retired. And he just feels a little bit useless. Like, he's got a lot of knowledge. Everyone respects him, but he's already retired, you know, and now what is he going to do? And then he sees Bo Peep, or he meets Bo Peep, and it's this long lost flame that sort of comes into his life. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. Like, whenever we got lost at Pixar, we would always go like, what's the real life analogy? What's the human analogy? And sometimes you don't hit it right away. Like, you cycle through a couple of analogies, and it's always this process of finding something that just feels right to everybody.
So it's at Sunnyside that we meet Lotso. And Lotso's such a fascinating villain. Of course, we don't realize that he's a villain straight away. He feels like he's constructed as someone who Woody could become, were he to allow the feeling of being rejected by his child to mutate into something dark and something more bitter within him. Can you talk to me about like the construction of that character in opposition to Woody, the sort of dialogue, the silent dialogue between the two characters?
Yeah, this was part of the conception of Lotso from the very beginning, was, you know, who is this character? Why are they the villain? Why are they in this story? And the reason, you know, a lot of times the reason that you have a villain in your story is to illuminate the darker parts of your hero. And so I remember very explicitly, it was, we had talked about how Lotso was a cautionary tale for Woody. It's what Woody could have become if he had gone down the wrong path, if he had found himself abandoned. And part of it is, Woody, I mean, I talk about this in of course, the video, is that your hero and your villain share a fundamental sort of understanding of the world. So even though Lotso is a bad guy and Woody's a good guy, as the movie begins, they look at the world through the same sort of prism or the same set of glasses. And that was, you know, Woody's gone. I was very lucky, I feel like, that the first two Toy Story movies had this recurring motif of Woody saying, like, our job is not to get played with, our job is to be there for Andy. We've got to be there for him. And it was very strongly emphasized that being there was this expression of love, like, he's there for us, we're there for him. And so then the thing that Lotso does is, if your kid loves you so much, why is he leaving? You know, and he's essentially saying, you know, if Andy's not going to be there for you anymore, if he's not going to be there for you, then it clearly means that he doesn't love you anymore. And now, like, Woody has to deal with that. So yeah, we talked early on very much about Lotso as this doppelganger to Woody. But then I remember also, I don't think that Lotso's backstory was there in the first draft of the movie. It was just, you just meet him and he's a bad guy and he doesn't believe in love between a child and a toy. But you don't really know why, and you don't know what his backstory was. And I remember being in some some story meeting there, and Andrew saying, like, well, we can't just say Lotso's evil. We have to understand why he's evil. And I was like, oh, great. Now I have to write this whole goddamn backstory about Lotso to explain how he got to be the way he is. And so then I had to bring up, like, you have to bring in Big Baby. You have to be Chuckles the Clown. Chuckles the Clown has to be there to serve as a witness. But we had to, I mean, God, it just took freaking forever. It just took so long to figure all that stuff out. But yeah, I think that hopefully it becomes satisfying at the end that Woody, at the climax of the movie, you know, when Andy's mom walks into the room and says, I wish I could always be there for you. And Andy says, you will be, mom, right? That's, to me, the philosophical climax of the movie, because that's when Woody realizes that being there for someone doesn't have to be literal. Like, you don't always have to be around somebody. Like, you can love somebody and let them go and let them go on with their life. and still be there for them in a larger sense. But Lasso is a character who never really learned that lesson. So that, but again, it was one of those things that it sort of wasn't there in the first draft. He was just like, Lasso was just an evil guy. And we had to come up with that whole backstory to explain why.
I suppose it's significant as well that like the first two films had had human antagonists and this time it was a toy. It feels like it kind of had to be a toy this time. Was there a sense that Lotso had to be the antagonist because and he had to be a toy for variety's sake as well? Was that something discussed?
Yeah, I think so. I think they were all very excited about having a toy antagonist, right? And then we had to really dig into like, well, what would a toy antagonist be? And what is a toy antagonist worldview? And I think that, and I say this in the video, and I think this is, again, one of the smartest screenwriting notes I ever heard in my life was, you know, you're talking about, okay, who is this antagonist? What is his worldview? Like, why is he so malevolent? Why does he not believe in the love between a child and a toy? And how you always want your antagonist's point of view, your bad guy's point of view to be like totally convincing. Like you want your antagonist's point of view to be as sort of unassailable as possible. And Andrew Stanton said at one point, he goes, listen, you know, if there's a dark truth at the heart of your movie, you can't avoid it. You can't steer away from it. Like if you steer away from some sort of dark truth in the center of your story, your audience is going to sense that you're just bullshitting them and they're going to disconnect with the story. And he goes, the truth about toys, I'm just going to say it right now because we all know it's true, is that nobody holds on to their toys forever. Like everybody leaves their toys behind. Like everybody, nobody at this table knows where their favorite toys are right now, or almost no. And John Lasseter raised his hand. He goes, I know where all my toys are. We're like, okay, yeah, but you're a weirdo. Like nobody else in the world knows where their childhood toys are. And Andrew's like, that's the truth of the relationship between a child and the toy, is that it's not going to last forever, right? It's ephemeral, right? It's a transient thing. And we can't ignore that. We have to like point straight towards that. So then you go, okay, then your bad guy is the guy who's bringing up this uncomfortable truth. Like you may love your kid. You may think your kid loves you, but like there's a ticking time bomb attached to this. Like, you know, your child is going to break your heart because he's going to grow up and he's going to leave you and you're still going to be in love with him and he's not going to be in love with you anymore. So any toy who falls in love with a kid is just a sucker because that love is not going to last forever. And because it's not going to last forever, it's not real, you know, so grow up. You know, there's no real love between a child and a toy. The best we can hope for is just to stay here at Sunnyside and have a new class of kids come in every year and just to get played with. And that's the best we can hope for. And I always thought that was just, it was so smart because it's just rooted in reality. Like it's just rooted in this sort of uncomfortable fact that we all have that like our toys are so meaningful to us when we're kids, like they're so important to us. Right. And we walk around with our teddy bear and hold on to them like all the time. And then at a certain point in your life, you have to put away childish things. And there's just a very melancholy moment attached to it. And so it was great to have this villain. I mean, again, the Prospector, I guess, was a little bit of a villain, you know, in Toy Story 2. But I feel like but he was more about like, I just want to live forever. And he didn't have a strong, he had never been played with. So he didn't have that experience. And to have somebody come in a toy and sort of say, love isn't real. Like the love that you feel is not going to last. And you're a sucker for believing it. Is a strong statement, and it just makes him a strong villain.
I think one of the lines from your video that really stuck with me is, I'm going to paraphrase you really bad, Michael, sorry about this, but you mentioned how like essentially that ugly truth that you mentioned, the antagonist should basically point out that ugly truth, but their approach to it should be petty and it should be bitter, and the protagonist, they're going to approach that same, they're going to confront that same truth, but with a more generous spirit, a more poetic spirit. And there's going to be some beauty in there. That completely blew my mind.
Listen, man, this was the hardest thing. I mean, there were a lot of hard things that we did on Toy Story 3, but this was to me the hardest thing, which was trying to figure out what Woody learns in the course of the story. And the way I analogize it a little bit is in Toy Story 1, Woody learns to share the spotlight with Buzz, right? And that developmentally tracks with a kid who's like 4, 5, 6 years old. Like it's very early. You have a new sibling comes in the household and you've got to learn to share the spotlight, right? And that's just sort of what you deal with when you're a very small child. In Toy Story 2, he learns to accept his mortality, right? Andy's going to grow up someday, but I'm going to enjoy the time we have. Now, and developmentally, that also tracks with someone who's like, let's say, 7, 8, 9 years old. Like, you become aware of your mortality, you realize that life is finite. So then the question is, like, you know, once you've learned to, like, share the spotlight and learn to accept your mortality, I say in my video, like, what else is there to learn? Like, you're pretty much done. And it was a real tricky thing to go, like, what is the next step forward for Woody? Like, what is the thing? What is the A to B arc, the thing that he doesn't know at the beginning that he learns at the end? And again, this is the just a way that the film changed from the first draft to the final draft was, I mean, Woody's epiphany in the first draft, and this was handed to me. I mean, this was the dialogue and the treatment that got handed to me, was his epiphany was, you know, Woody says at the end of the first draft of the movie, I've always said that the job of a toy is to make a child happy, but I realize now that Andy's not a child anymore, so I'm ready to let him go. And as I say in the video, it's just a terrible epiphany to give your hero. As we've seen the whole movie that Andy's not a child anymore, it makes your hero seem like a dumb guy, right? That he hasn't picked that up yet. So then it was this very difficult, oh my God, this was the hardest thing. It was this this endless, endless process of going like, how can we have Woody take a step forward or flip the binoculars at the philosophical climax of the story and change his mind about things? And especially, how can he accept, you know, going separate ways from Woody, right? That's what you're really trying to tee up, is that he's going to put himself in the donation box and tee up Andy to make the decision to hand him off. And so why does he not want to go to college with Andy? Why is he okay with letting go of Woody? And just to make a long story short, I've already sort of alluded to it. I just go back to the language that was established in the previous films, that like, our job is to be there. Our job is to be there. And a lot of times what you're doing in an epiphany moment is that you're changing the meaning of a specific word from a literal sense to a metaphorical sense. So, you know, for example, in It's a Wonderful Life, you know, you go through the whole, George Bailey goes through the whole movie thinking that that Mr. Potter is the richest man in town, right? And literally, that's true. Mr. Potter is the richest man in town. But when you get to the philosophical climax of the movie, George's war hero brother flies to a blizzard, comes in, raises a toast, and goes to George Bailey, the richest man in town. And you're just flipping the meaning of what riches are. You know, I use in the video the same example for Up. You're just redefining what adventure is. So I had those examples very much in mind, It's a Wonderful Life and Up, in my mind when I was searching around for what Woody's epiphany could be and how he takes a step forward, or how his understanding evolves, going from a lots of way of seeing the world to a better way of seeing the world. And it just circled back to that fundamental language that was established in the previous Toy Story films of, our job is to be there for Andy. And so you're just going, I'm going to redefine what it means to be there for someone.
The Prison Break movie within the second act, it's so much fun, and it kind of is something we hadn't seen in a Toy Story movie prior to this. It's interesting, the kind of spread of interpretations of this segment of the film. Like, one sort of popular reading of this second act drew a lot of comparisons to kind of the Holocaust, and I'm curious, like, I asked the same question to Lee Unkrich, and he said that there was he never considered it that way. Was there anything for you in there that was deeper than what we see on screen?
No, I think that feels like it would be a little tasteless to make it an analogy of the Holocaust. I think the Holocaust is its own thing. And I think that, I mean, obviously, because, you know, we had to choose, like, what was going to be the ultimate threat to the toys at the end. And I mean, toys are kind of weird characters because they're a little bit like vampires. They never really die, right? And so I was just like, okay, the only way you can really put them in jeopardy is, you know, at the dump, is you either have a shredder or you have an incinerator. And so I was like, well, what's worse? You know, because you want to have both of them be threatening, but it has to be escalating. So I put the shredder first and the incinerator second. But I think just having the incinerator be the final threat sort of prompted some of those analogies, which I think are a little bit unfortunate. I think that we mostly had just talked about Sunnyside as sort of an authoritarian state, that it was a little bit like North Korea, right? And that that Lhotse was this dictator who was determining who could be in the caterpillar room, who had to be in the butterfly room. And that was his means of social control. And then he had his muscle. He had Big Baby, who was the enforcer, you know? There was never any explicit connection to the Holocaust.
One thing about this segment that I was curious about, like a more direct, more linear way of telling the story would never have involved breaking up Woody from the main group. Now, of course, it adds such depth and complication, the fact that he breaks up the family, he goes on his own path because he believes he has to get back to Andy. The rest of the gang are all quite excited to get to this new place and be played with again. There are so many benefits to sort of taking this path. For one, you know, as you say in the video, like it makes Woody active instead of him just being along for the ride and these things happening to all the characters. But yeah, can you tell me about like the degree to which like it was always in there from the very first draft that he was going to go off on his own path and he was going to have to make a heroic return to save his friends?
Yeah, no, totally. I think this was a really smart choice that Andrew made, was to split Woody off from the other characters, because what it allows you to do is, you know, when the characters start off, they think their only options are, you know, going to the attic or going into the trash. Like that's kind of it. They can get played with by Molly, but they, you know, we tried to establish early on that wasn't really a great option. And so you're just establishing that that's their range of possibilities. And so the thing that you get, the benefit that you get in the second act of splitting off Woody and having him go on his own adventure, is that he accidentally, right, gets picked up by Bonnie and taken into Bonnie's room, and he meets all of Bonnie's toys and he gets along with them, and they're this wacky theater troupe, and you go, oh, these guys are kind of fun, right? But I remember Andrew also saying that, like, that's giving you the solution of a new home that the characters couldn't see at the beginning of the story. Like your act two is giving you something that you never could have imagined in act one. And then I remember Andrew also saying, like, because that's going to be our final solution, because the place that the toys end up in, we have to do everything we can to disguise the fact that Woody's going to end up back there. Like, we've got to play it as though that Bonnie's just an obstacle, right? That Woody's trying to get back home to Andy. He escapes from Sunnyside. He gets stuck in the tree, and Bonnie coming along and picking him up and putting him in the backpack feels like it's just an obstacle. Like it's another complication of the story. It's taking your hero away from his goal, which is getting back to Andy. But what you're really subtly doing is setting up your final payoff. And so that's just really, really smart storytelling. The thing that wasn't smart storytelling actually in the first draft, and this is a big way in which the first draft differed from the finished film, and it was a complete nightmare. It was a complete nightmare, like trying to figure this thing out, was the first act break of the story. And I say this in the video, God, in the first draft, the first act was that the Woody doesn't leave. He just stays with all his friends at Sunnyside. The toddlers come in, they play roughly with the toys, and then they all realize that the place is a prison and they're all trapped, right? And so what happened was, Woody was trapped along with all the other toys there. And so then the second quarter of the film was just this sort of horror show that like they keep getting abused, they keep getting played with roughly, and they're trying to figure what to do. And part of the second quarter of the first draft was Woody sort of figuring out, like, we've got to bust out of here. Like, we've got to break out of here. And so in the early draft, Woody engineered, I'm trying to remember how this all worked, but he engineered a thing where he got himself into trouble and he got himself put into the box, right? Into the sandbox, deliberately got himself in trouble so he'd be put in the sandbox. And then he used getting put in the sandbox as a means of escape. And then he escaped and went off to try and get home and see Andy. And then there had to be a midpoint. The midpoint was different because when Woody got to Bonnie's house, Bonnie's toys explained to him, oh, there's going to be like a rummage sale or a garage sale at the at Sunnyside, and it's coming up on Monday or it's coming up tomorrow. There was a ticking clock attached to it, but it was like the annual sort of toy apocalypse where like all the parents would come in and buy toys, or they would throw away toys or something like that. You were just trying to add an extra level of jeopardy, so that Woody would A, know that Sunnyside was a bad place, B, escape from it to go back to Andy's, and then see when he got to Bonnie's room, find, oh, wait, there's an additional level of jeopardy that I didn't know about. And now I have to go back and rescue the toys. And it's all, it's just one of those examples of sort of bad storytelling that when you explain it, you go, oh, that kind of works, but not really, you know? And so, and this is the way it was for, you know, a year, just a long, long time was Woody kept, Woody just was stayed at Sunnyside for the second quarter of the movie. And I remember Lee Unkrich saying, like, I never feel comfortable with the idea that that Woody would know that Sunnyside was a bad place and still leave his friends there. He goes, that just doesn't feel like Woody. Woody would never do that. And so the answer, which of course seems completely obvious in retrospect, is that you have to have Woody leave Sunnyside right away. So we took what was initially the midpoint of the movie, which was Woody escaping from Sunnyside, and put that at the second, at the end of the first act of the story. But again, that's one of those things that just like in your first draft, it kind of makes sense. Like there's a story, there's a logic to it, and you explain it, you go, okay, that kind of works, but emotionally it doesn't work. And you just sit there. It's one of those things that it's, again, it's like having an itch that you can't scratch, man. It's just like, you go like, okay, this isn't quite working, but I don't know why, I don't know how. Right. And you just sit there. And then finally, you know, again, when you come up with a solution, everyone realizes it's a solution. Like a test of a strong idea is that everyone goes, oh, that's the way it has to be, right? A test of a strong idea is that everyone thinks in retrospect, that's the way it had to be. Like it seems very obvious in retrospect, but it doesn't seem obvious. I'll tell you, man, it's not seem obvious when you're sitting there trying to figure it out, like in real time.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, alleviating a lot of that darkness is this kind of burgeoning relationship between Barbie and Ken. I'm weirdly fascinated by the kind of toy brands that do and don't appear in these films as they roll on. One thing that I noticed in some of the kind of like early reels, you have Transformers in the background, you have He-Man in the background. And I wondered whether like those were kind of toys that were written into the script at any point, but it kind of fell through because of licensing reasons or anything like that. Is there anything to be read into their presence in the reels?
Yeah, no, I would imagine that Transformers, I mean, Transformers is a Paramount thing. So I would imagine that Transformers are just not going to end up in a Toy Story movie. Just, I mean, they could, but they probably won't. And He-Man sort of would probably, I mean, again, it was just being, you know, you have to license the image and it would be a problem. I do remember when we got to Bonnie's room, I remember writing a Totoro plushie like into Bonnie's room. Just because I love Miyazaki so much and I love Totoro so much. And I just wrote him in. And I go like, you know, maybe it can happen, but I didn't really expect it. But Pixar had to go to Studio Ghibli. And I think it was John Lasseter specifically asking Miyazaki, can we please have a Toto, you know, plushie in our film? And Miyazaki was very gracious and very generous in letting us keep it. But it's a funny thing that you have to, yeah, you have to just sort of be cognizant of like what you're going to be able to get away with. But I remember everyone was very excited to have a Ken character in the movie. They said, you know, we had introduced Barbie in Toy Story 2, and now we're going to introduce Ken in Toy Story 3.
Yeah, you know, Toy Story 3 walked, so this year's Barbie could run in some regards.
But funny thing, I got to tell you a story about this, because this is a great just story about storytelling in general. Which was when they first told me, okay, we're going to have Barbie and Ken together. And I was like, okay, let me think about this. Like, how can I make them funny? Like, how are we going to like these characters? Because, you know, Barbie has everything. She has the dream house and she has the dune buggy. And Ken, you know, he has all his clothes. Like, how are you going to like these people? Like, how are you going to get along with them? And I thought about it for like a week and I came up with nothing. It was like, what are you going to do to make people like Barbie and Ken? Like, I just came up with nothing. And I came back and Lee was like, well, how's it going with Barbie and Ken? Well, like, what are your thoughts about them? And I was like, man, I got nothing. Like, I don't know how to make these characters funny at all. You know? And Lee was like, well, we were thinking maybe it could be a Barbie who's never met a Ken and a Ken who's never met a Barbie. And as soon as he said that, I was like, don't tell me anything more. I know exactly how to do it. It's funny. Once you get that one idea, right? I just was able to trace the whole arc of like what was going to happen to them. Obviously they were going to meet for the first time and fall madly in love with each other. They were going to have this romantic infatuation at the beginning. They're going to sort of have a breakup with each other sort of halfway through, and then they're going to reconcile at the end. But it's a tricky thing, like, because for that first week, I'd just been thinking it was a Barbie who had met a million Kens. It was a Ken who had met a million Barbies. And when these two characters are going to meet, they're just going to go, oh, another Ken. Oh, another Barbie. Like, there's nowhere you can go with that. Or there's not that there's nowhere that you can go with that. But it's really hard to figure out how to spark some sort of comic energy out of it. And if you just, it was just this one idea of like a Barbie who's never met a Ken and a Ken who's never met a Barbie. And then you go, you're just off and running at that point. So, and again, it's just, I take my hat off. I mean, this is what was so illuminating to me about my Pixar experience is that you can sit by yourself in a room and try and solve a story problem for weeks and weeks, and you won't make any progress at all. And then you can mention your problem to somebody else and they'll solve it in 10 seconds, you know? And it's very humbling as a writer, because we all like to think that we're masters of the universe that we create, but it's so helpful to have other people come in from other perspectives. And I'm just telling you, man, it was just such a great experience to be at Pixar, to be in those story meetings, and to have so much help. Man, I got so much help. There's no way in a million years I could have written that screenplay, my story three, by myself. I got so much help, you wouldn't even believe it. Like, there were times when there'd be like 30 people in a room together meeting for two full days, trying to help me make the story better. That's how much help I got writing Toy Story 3.
We should talk also about finding a role for Buzz amidst all this. Like, it doesn't feel like this when watching the film, but on paper, like, you know, there's an echo of his arc in the first film to what happens to him in this third film. Could you talk me through the kind of delicacy of like giving him this plot involving him being returned to his factory settings with somehow not regurgitating the first film along the way? It's really expertly done.
This is a great question. And it goes back to, I'll just explain like what happened was, which was, the original sort of Toy Story group went off and they brainstormed ideas for 2 days, and they came up with the basics of the plot, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And then Andrew came back and wrote it into it like a 25-page treatment and handed it to me. And so then I, based on that treatment, I went off just and very quickly wrote down the first draft. And so the first draft was really just an adaptation of whatever was there in that first treatment. And in the wake of that first draft, they made a first set of reels. They did the reel screening. And man, I'll just tell you, that first reel screening was a total nightmare for me. Like, it was like I had done my best. Like, I had done my best to turn the treatment into a finished script. And then that finished script got turned into the set of reels, a rough version of the movie. And then we all go into the main theater and we screen that first set of reels for the audience. And at the end of it, the lights come up and there's this really tepid sort of half-hearted applause. And we get up and everyone starts filing out of the theater and no one's making eye contact with me. And everyone's just like avoiding my eyes. And it's just one of those moments in your life where you just have this cold sinking sensation in your gut. You're just like, I am fucking this up. Like, this is not working and I'm fucking it up. And like, I'm in emergency. I need to go into emergency mode now to try and fix this. In the wake of that first screening, and I don't know if it was, I think they had always planned this. They would be a first screening and then they were going to do a big offsite. The big offsite is everyone leaves Pixar. They go up to a resort in Napa Valley or Sonoma Valley, something like that. And again, it's like 30 guys spend two full days in a conference room trying to go through the first draft of the movie and going, okay, what's wrong? How can we fix it? And this is just another great example of like the writing process at Pixar was, I remember John Lasseter saying, you know, we spent a day and a half talking about the movie. And then there was a certain lull in the conversation. And John just said, you know, it feels like we're going back to the same well with Buzz. Like, we're just turning him into a deluded space ranger again. And we've kind of done it before. And, you know, we know it's going to work. We know it's going to be entertaining, but we've done it before. And how can we like not repeat ourselves? And he just says, I wish there was another mode. Maybe there's another mode that Buzz could be in. And people started throwing ideas like onto the table. People were like, there's a fast motion Buzz, there's a slow motion Buzz, there's a vibrating Buzz, things like that. And I was sitting next to Andrew and I just turned to him and I sort of muttered, I was like, a Spanish Buzz. Like, but it was just an aside to him. Like, I wasn't really proposing it. And Andrew slammed his hand on the table and he goes, Spanish Buzz. And like everybody like sort of erupting goes, oh my God, Spanish Buzz. Like all the animators could see where this was going. And I'm just telling the story because, again, it goes to show the writing process at Pixar, which is you needed one guy, John, to go, we're repeating ourselves. There's a problem. We need to come up with something new, right? You needed another guy, the idiot me, who actually goes Spanish Buzz, but doesn't really believe that that idea is going to work. And you need another guy to go, no, that's the right idea. That's what we need to do. And it's, again, it's such a great example of how nobody on their own could have come up with this idea. It had to be sort of three brains together in a room that would produce, you know, this sort of idea like Spanish Buzz, which again, sort of, I think is one of the comedy highlights of the movie.
Yeah, I love how becoming Spanish Buzz unlocks something in him. Like, he's able to access this romantic side of himself that then in turn allows his relationship with Jesse to progress.
Yeah, it's just a fun thing that you go, now that he's Spanish Buzz, you know, we're flirting with ethnic stereotypes a little bit here, but it was just a chance to have him, you know, express what was really inside him. And then, I mean, you get the joke at the end where Woody says to Jesse, you're going to be okay in the attic. And Jesse goes, yeah, I'll be fine. I know about Buzz's Spanish mode, you know, and Buzz goes, what mode? But yeah, you just, you know, you want it to be this vehicle of growth for Buzz, that he's going to take one little step forward and be able to hold Jesse's hand at the end and not sort of freak out.
We should talk about the ending, Michael. I still remember exactly, you know, watching the experience of watching it for the first time and watching these characters who'd been a part of my life at this point for, you know, over a decade, holding hands and awaiting their fate as friends, as this incinerator looms, all hope seems to be lost. And you've disguised so perfectly the sort of alien characters kind of sneaking away, and the callback of the claw, it's so perfect. Can you tell me about constructing this whole sequence? You mentioned earlier that the dump wasn't initially part of the plans. So how did this scene all come together?
Golly, let me just say, I'll tell you what the initial third act was. The initial third act in the first draft was they escape from Sunnyside, and then they realize that Andy's leaving for college in like 10 minutes, and they have no time to get home to Andy's house. And so the initial third act of the film, I don't know if anyone's talked about this publicly or discussed it, but the initial third act was they realize they're right next to Al's Toy Barn. And so they go into Al's Toy Barn, they get a radio controlled car, a radio controlled motorcycle, and a radio controlled airplane. And they're going to use that to get back to Andy's house in time. And then they all try and take off, and they immediately collide with each other. And they get themselves sorted out, they get back on their vehicles, and they take off. And then they realize retroactively that they all grabbed the wrong remote controllers. So the people on the motorcycle are controlling the car, the people in the car on the airplane. And so you have this, it's sort of this comedy sprint to the finish where you have a ticking clock and Andy's about to leave for college. And then we had this thing where the battery, the motorcycle runs out of batteries and they have to all hop on the car. And then the car runs out of batteries and all have to hop on the plane. And then the climax was they all are on the plane and they just fly through the window and go smashing into Andy's bedroom just as he's walking up the stairs and he finds his toys there and packs them all away. And so that was, you know, this is about like the difference between the first draft and the final film. That was the first draft, like I wrote that whole version of the story. And then when we got to this offsite, which was again like 2 days away from Pixar, like, you know, having these story meetings, and Lee Unkrich said, like, if this is the last Toy Story film, then we have to go to the end of a toy's life cycle. Like, we have to see, like, what the end looks like for toys. And I think Lee's a pretty, you know, he's got a pretty dark sense of humor, you know. And so he wanted to go to that end point and see what it looked like and see, you know, sort of what toys inevitably face. And so we had to, you know, this is, you just throw out the whole third act of the first act and of the first draft, and you come up with a new thing. And so then it was this question of, you know, what's going to happen at the dump. And I mean, again, this is a good lesson for writing, which is, you know, you always just want to make things worse for your characters. You always want to make things as bad as possible. And so we had to, and so I was just like, well, what's worse, being shredded or being incinerated? And so it was, I think, incinerated. So then for a long, long time, you have to set up this whole thing where, you know, they get on this conveyor belt and they're going up and they just barely escape from the shredder. And then they see some daylight on the horizon and you think they're going to get away. But no, it's the incinerator. And then for a long time, like I just set it up that, like, you know, they end up in the incinerator and they're going down into the pit and they're all going to be burned alive. And then somehow they get out, you know, and we totally hadn't figured it out. Like, we totally didn't know what to do. And for like 6 months, we're like, and then they somehow get out. And we go, we'll solve it later. And then finally, one day, I remember going into the story meeting. I was like, nobody's leaving the story room until we figure out how the fuck they get out of the incinerator. Because like, it just seemed like a problem that just didn't have a solution. And then the thing that you do as a screenwriter, this is just helpful, is that when you just have no answers and you don't know what to do, you just start making lists. You just make a list of like, okay, what's there? What could we use? Like, what is nearby? And we had done these research trips to the waste processing facility, and we had seen what the incinerator looks like. We had seen that magnetic belt actually that was lifting up all the metal. You know, as soon as I saw that, I was like, that's going in the movie. But you know, the other thing, so we just started making a list of everything that we had seen on our research trip. We were like, there's an incinerator, there's the bulldozers that push stuff around, there's all these plastic bags flying everywhere and stuff like that. And then at this facility, there was like a big claw, and we go, there's a claw. And as soon as we said that, as soon as you go, oh, that's something that we can use, then you go, okay, that's the solution. Like, that's what it is. But it's one of those things that, like, a writer, you shouldn't be afraid to put yourself into a seemingly insoluble situation, because usually there's a way to figure it out. Usually there's something, there's a solution to the problem that you've created for yourself. So even if you don't know what that solution is, go ahead and create like a horrible situation for your character, and you'll be able to figure a way out of it. But yeah, we didn't have that solution for a long, long, long time. And it was this, again, it was this itch I couldn't scratch. It was this source of like stress and anxiety that like somehow we're going to have to figure out a brilliant, clever way to get the toys out of trouble. And then, I mean, this is the thing that I just say, is that like the ideas came along when we needed them, you know, and like, where do ideas come from? God only knows where ideas come from. Half your job as a writer is coming up with ideas, and like, where do they come from? How, you can't force them to come, you know? But I just felt like on Toy Story 3, we were very lucky that when we need an idea, it sort of came right on schedule.
I can imagine the euphoria of when you realized you could call back to the first film and the claw, that kind of timeless quote.
I remember when we first pitched it to John Lasseter, and we were like, they're about to go into the fire, and you think it's doom, and Woody closes his eyes, and you think it's all over, and then a light turns on above him, and he looks up, and he sees above him, and it's a giant claw that comes down and rescues him, and it's the aliens. And John, I remember him slapping the table and laughing and going, yes, 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 that's it. And that's the moment where, like, I was just like, this better work, because I don't have any other ideas. Like you better approve this story idea, because I have no other ideas. But he was right on board with it, and so that was a huge relief too.
And that, of course, leads us to the film's beautiful coda. It's not just a coda for the film. At the time, it was seemingly, you know, a coda for the entire franchise, like a signing off point for these characters and this world that Pixar had built. If it's okay with you, Michael, I'm going to read a quote of yours that I found really moving about the end scene and some of the sentiments that it's expressing. You've described Toy Story 3 as a film about the universal drama of parenthood, but also about more than that. All of us go through our lives meeting people and growing deeply connected to them. Then life intervenes. We have to move on with our lives, and we're not with them anymore. We all have that best friend or high school sweetheart or colleague from our first job. You get to know these people. You form deep attachments to them. Then life leads them somewhere else. And you go, how real was that relationship? In our darker moments, we can be tempted to think it was transient and meaningless. If it had been real, wouldn't we have stayed together? The answer is you can love someone and not always be with them. Sometimes the most loving thing is to let someone go. That is such a special sentiment to be underpinning a movie like this, Michael. Like, you've explained in your YouTube video the kind of logic that led you to this point, to this end scene and that sentiment. But one thing that isn't really expanded upon in your video is how it must have felt to come to the realization that this was what the movie had to ultimately say, that this was the message the film kind of had to earn. It's so emotional to watch that scene at the end as that kind of message is expressed. Was it emotional to write?
Totally. Let me make a small observation and then really answer your question. The other thing that we did, and one of the things that I think makes the ending very emotional, is that there's a big mislead at the end. that we mislead the audience into thinking that Woody's put himself in the college box and that he hasn't been donated. And there's actually a shot towards the end where the camera tracks in on the college box, and then you cut to within the college box and you're looking out through the handholds. So you're very strongly implying that Woody is still in the college box and he's watching this thing happen. And I think, I mean, humor, a lot of humor depends on surprise and having something unexpected happen. But I think it's also for emotion, right? So we had to create this very strong mislead that Woody was in the college box so that when you discover that he's actually put himself in the donation box and he's there at the bottom, that you're not expecting it. Like, you're not expecting that Woody would have put himself in this situation and made this sort of sacrifice or led to this point. And I think that's one of the reasons that the emotion comes so strongly. If you knew that Woody was already there, right, your emotional defenses would be up and would be prepared for it. But part of the reason that the ending is so emotional is because it's unexpected. You didn't think that Woody was in that box, and then Bonnie leans and goes, "My cowboy," right? And you go, "Oh my God." Like, and you're processing emotionally in real time what's happening because you haven't prepared. You weren't expecting him to be in the college box. And then to answer your question, I remember when I was writing that first draft and I wrote it, you know, start to finish. So I started on page one and I went through to page 120 or whatever it was. And I remember, you know, and as you're writing, you're just making this stuff up, right? As you go, you're just freaking making it up. But as we went, I wrote it in real time, and I probably wrote it over the course of like 2 months. I wrote in chronological order. And throughout the story, Woody keeps insisting, "Guys, I know you don't believe me, but Andy still cares about us. Like, I know it doesn't seem that way, but you gotta trust me. Andy still cares about us. You can't give up on him. You can't give up on him. He still cares about us," right? And throughout the whole movie, everyone's going, "Grow up, Woody. It's over. He's grown up. He's going to college. He doesn't care about us anymore. We have to move on," right? So then I got to the ending and I'm sitting down. I remember there was a day, I remember my office, like there in the little story pod there. And I go in and I'm like, "Okay, Andy's given away all his toys." And I had to sit down and write them all. And you want it to be in escalating order. So you want Woody to be the last one that's given away. So you have to have, you know, Andy take out each of his toys and introduce them and personalize them. So this is Buzz Lightyear, the coolest toy ever made. And I remember, "Oh, and this is the potato heads. They're madly in love with each other. You got to keep them all together." And so I'm sitting there writing and I get to like the final thing, which is Andy handing over Woody. And I'm sitting there going, "Okay, what can Andy say about Woody that's interesting, that makes sense?" And if you think about it, you go, okay, the thing that Andy should say about Woody is, what is it about Woody that makes Woody different from the rest of the toys, right? And I just remember sitting down and writing, like, Woody's brave like a cowboy should be, and he's kind and he's smart, but the thing that makes Woody special is he'll never give up on you. He'll be there for you no matter what. And I remember writing this and just like tears just like flowing down my cheeks, because it was such a vindication for Woody and his faith in Andy. You know, it was such a vindication that despite all the evidence that he had been right all along, that Andy still loved them and cared about them. And it's just one of those signs as a writer that you're onto something good if you're kind of weeping as you write the dialogue. And I remember finishing writing that scene and just like my face just like red and streaked with tears and going, "Oh my God, like Andy just gave away Woody. Like a bomb has gone off and nobody knows it." And I remember walking outside my office and like life was going on as normal. Everybody's sitting there typing or talking on the phone. And I just felt like this huge thing had just happened and nobody knew about it yet. Like I just made this thing happen. I just knew it was going to be, just based on my own reaction, like while writing it, I knew it was going to be emotional. And then you just have these incredibly talented animators who are able to, and these great voice actors who are able to bring it to life and make it really work in a way. But I just feel like I was very lucky as a writer that things lined up very in a way that was very lucky for me, and that everything turned out as well as it did on this project.
Well, contrary to your fears at the offset of the project, you didn't mess it up at all, Michael. It wasn't a disaster in the slightest. In fact, it was a massive success. So much so that you made history, I believe, you became the first screenwriter to be Oscar nominated for their first two screenplays, winning one of them. Do I have that right? Is that the stat?
Yeah, I think that Paddy Chayefsky, I think, got nominated for his first two screenplays. I think it was Hospital and Network.
But
again, it was a lot of stress. It was a lot to live up to. But again, I was very lucky in having this huge, huge team. I had the biggest set of training wheels you could have. So just very smart, funny, talented people helping me out the whole way through. So I got nominated, but with, you know, the help of a lot of other people.
And did overcoming the anxiety of kind of taking on characters as beloved as Woody and Buzz, did that help when it came to taking on Star Wars? You know, the Toy Story 3 must have been a great apprenticeship in both kind of servicing and shutting down the voices in your head telling you millions of people worldwide are unbelievably passionate about these characters, Michael. Here's what they're expecting. Here's what, you know, it's expected upon you to deliver.
Yeah, I think that, I remember saying yes to Star Wars and going like, I've immediately made a million enemies, right? Because if 100 million people, if 100 million people go see the movie and 99% of them like it, that still means there's going to be a million people who hate it and who are going to blame me and I'm going to be their enemy. So like, it's just the act of saying yes means that a million people are going to hate my guts, you know, at the end of this process. I do feel like one of the promises when I started working on Star Wars was that they wanted to try and replicate the Pixar experience. They wanted to have a brain trust. They wanted to bring other filmmakers in. They wanted everybody out there helping each other. And I don't want to delve too deeply into this, but what ended up happening was that there was a release date that couldn't be moved. And so that process, which was going to be this sort of iterative collaborative process, ended up not happening on Star Wars. But I think that the process that I went through at Pixar, I mean, again, it changed my whole perspective on writing. Like, I went from being this sort of like a prickly loner on Little Miss Sunshine and just not wanting any feedback or help from anybody to really, really going like, you know, writing is a team sport. You need other people. And it's just some of the most fun, engaging, exhilarating moments of my life have been sitting in story meetings at Pixar and having people just throwing out ideas. Being in a room full of a bunch of smart people is one of the most fun things that you can do. And so I feel like I've been trying to replicate that Pixar experience, you know, ever since I left there.
It is interesting, like you've been custodian to so many beloved characters, almost one from each of the last few generations. So of course, Luke and Han in Star Wars were heroes to kind of 80s kids. If you were born in the 90s, you love Woody and Buzz. You grew up with those guys. And I think Katniss Everdeen is kind of iconic amongst a more recent generation. Have you learned anything from penning stories for such beloved characters about what makes the kind of character who can inspire that ferocity of love and devotion amongst moviegoers?
Boy, that's a good question. I feel like that's a huge, huge question.
Yeah, we're quite late in the day.
I'm kind of unprepared to answer. Yeah, exactly. I need another cup of coffee. I think that the thing that you have to do is, I mean, for me, it's wanting to be, you know, I was very lucky in what I'm doing is inheriting characters, right? Like, they're not my characters. Buzz and Woody are not my characters. Katniss is not my character. Like, we were trying to invent Rey, you know, I will take some credit for inventing Rey as a scavenger girl on a desert planet. But Luke is not my character either. So what you're trying to do is honor, you know, those characters, your understanding of those characters. And you never want to misserve those characters, right? You never want to, again, make them sound in a way that they don't sound, like make them do things that they wouldn't normally do. And just, you just really want to respect them. And I remember, I'll just say on Katniss, it was interesting. One of the things I learned writing Catching Fire was to not give her too much to say, because she actually, by having her remain quiet and be this sort of watchful presence, it actually made her a more powerful person. That if there was a scene with a lot of dialogue in it, a lot of times I would overwrite the scene and have Katniss talking, you know, to everybody else. And what I realized is a lot of times, if you take out all her dialogue in the middle of the movie so that she's listening throughout the story, and then she just makes a decision, she just says something at the very end, it makes her a more powerful character. She's the one who's deciding which way the story's going. So Yeah, listen, I've been very lucky. I'm the luckiest screenwriter in the world. Like, I've been very lucky to, I was very lucky with Little Miss Sunshine that we got such a great cast and such great directors, and it turned out as well as it did. I was very, very lucky to be hired at Pixar and to spend 5.5 years there and learn so much from them. And then I've been very, very lucky to be asked to be custodians of both the Hunger Games characters and the Star Wars characters. And you just don't want to screw it up, right? And I think the way you don't screw it up is that you just, you try and honor sort of the spirit of those characters as best you understand them and listen to other people, you know, have other people say, oh, this is not what Woody sounds like. You know, you have to change this. And I'll go, okay, you know, you don't throw a temper tantrum and tell people, no, I'm going to reinvent Woody. Like, that's not what your job is really about.
That makes a lot of sense. Two quick questions, Michael, from our Patreon supporters. Laurent, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Laurent. Huge apologies if not. Laurent is a big fan of your videos on screenwriting theory and wonders, are there particular structural things or other screenwriting elements that you wish more films would embrace? Because a lot of the brilliant fundamentals that Pixar is so attuned to, not every film kind of pays the same attention to them, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, I'll say I just was last week down at the Austin Screenwriting Conference, and I just gave a talk about first acts and how to write a great first act. And I feel like first acts are devalued because first acts are kind of deceptive in that first acts are almost automatically entertaining. Like you're meeting new characters, you're getting into new situations. So every first act is, when you sit down and watch them, they're almost always entertaining. But, you know, Billy Wilder says if you have a problem in your third act, the real problem is in your first act. And I'll go further than that and say if you have a problem in your second act, the real problem is probably in your first act. So I was just down in Austin and I gave this whole talk in which I quoted Andrew Stanton. He once said, we were in a story meeting and he just said, I don't think your first act is doing the work you need it to do. I forget what film he was talking about, but I remember thinking that that was such a smart way of looking at a first act, which is, the job of your first act is not just to be entertaining. The job of your first act is to set up your second act and to set up your third act. And I feel like the process of writing a great first act is something that is not appreciated as much as it could be. Everybody knows what a good ending is. Like, everybody knows that a good ending is important, and it's really hard to write a good ending. But everybody recognizes that. I feel like fewer people recognize how difficult it is to write a great first act. And I'll just say that the examples that I was using for great first acts down in Austin were The Bicycle Thief, The Godfather, and also Tootsie. Like, those are great first acts, and maybe I'll make a video sometime in the future about how to write a great first act.
Well, you've made a great video on endings, so it seems the logical logical next move. Another member of our Patreon community, Mark Ramsey, wanted to know quite simply your approach to an idea. What's your approach, Michael, once an idea for a story has come to you? Is there kind of a process that you fall back on each time for seeing if that story has enough legs in it to sustain a full movie, if it's interesting enough to devote the time into kind of taking it further and developing into a screenplay?
Yeah, that's actually also a great question, because a lot of times when you first have an idea, like, it's just half a story, right? It's not a full story. And so you're sitting there trying to think, like, can I turn this into a movie? Is this a full story or not? And I'll just try and be brief here. I think for me, I just had an idea just recently. One of the scripts I'm working on now is about a young woman who wants to be a chef. And I had this character in my head for a long time. I had bits of dialogue in my head for a long time. What I didn't have was, I didn't have sort of a first act break of the movie. I didn't have sort of a narrative motor that was going to get me through the second half of the story, through the second act of the story. And I didn't have an ending. And so I just was like, yeah, I think this would make a great movie, but I wasn't going to start writing it until I knew what the second act motor was and what the ending was. And I figured out the second act motor, and then it took a longer time to figure out what the ending was. But once I figured out what the ending was, I was like, boom, that's a movie. And so I was able to write it. So I think that, you know, I'll just say, if you go and watch, sorry to plug them, but if you go watch my videos, I talk about these six tentpole moments of storytelling. You know, your opening, inciting incident, first act break, midpoint, second act break, and climax, and how those moments in storytelling correspond to the language of fairy tales. Once upon a time, there was a young girl, right? And every day she XYZ. And every day she dreamed of PDQ. And every day there was some sort of internal problem. And then one day, inciting incident happened. And in the wake of that inciting incident, she didn't know what to do. But then, you know, she decided on, you know, something else happened, and she realized she was had to embark on some sort of quest. And that's your first act break. So I think that if you can, if you have an idea, if you can sit there and tell your story in a fairy tale form, touching on each of those six tentpole moments and just knowing like how it's going to, what each of those tentpole moments are, then you know that you have a movie or not yet. And I personally, I'll just say I wouldn't start writing anything unless I could tell myself what the opening, what the inciting incident, what the first act break was, like what each of those tentpole moments were. And I just did that with this Chef comedy. Like I had everything except the ending, and I was not going to write it until I knew what the ending was going to be. And once I figured that out, I was like, okay, that's a movie now I can write. I hope that's an answer that's helpful.
That's a great answer. Chef comedy sounds fascinating. Is there anything else before we let you go, Michael, that you can tell us about what's coming next from you, what we've got to look forward to?
I'm just hoping to start directing stuff. So I have a credit, a shared screenplay credit on the Hunger Games film that's coming out, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. I worked on that just when the pandemic started happening. But mostly what I've been doing for the last couple of years is trying to go back to my sort of Little Miss Sunshine roots and writing my own original scripts and mostly original comedies. And so I feel like I have three or four scripts now that are in the starter's gate and are pretty much ready to go. And I'm hoping as soon as the actors strike ends that we can start sending the scripts out to actors and trying to cast these things, but trying to keep a low budget and just go back to sort of low budget comedy like Little Miss Sunshine that I'd done before.
That's so exciting. Well, on that note, Michael, I can't thank you enough for this conversation. It's been absolutely fascinating. And I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today.
Okay, man. I thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. It's a real pleasure to just talk about the craft of storytelling. And I'm just, if you don't mind, I'm just going to go and plug my website once again, because if anyone's listening to this and you're a screenwriter, I just like everything I know about storytelling, I've put into this sort of handful of videos that are on YouTube and also on my website, which is the name of my company is Pandemonium Inc. INC. So if you just go to Pandemonium Inc. .com. That's where it's just all my videos are, everything I know about storytelling is there. And I hope it's helpful. People have told me that these videos are helpful in terms of like explaining sort of how stories work or my understanding of stories. And it's just me putting stuff out there that I wish I had known when I was first starting out. So people have told me they're helpful. I hope they'll be helpful to your listeners too.
Yeah, I can personally vouch for that. Before I started this show, I was on that website. So yeah, please do, everyone, if you're not already familiar, go check it out. Michael, thank you so much. This has been such a blast.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you. And thanks for what you do. Just highlighting screenwriters and the very difficult and painful work that we do. I hope people really appreciate it then. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow, you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.